Welcome to the Global Security and Protection Group podcast. This is your host, Ron Jacobus. We hope you enjoy these conversations in executive protection and security management as we meet with security practitioners and industry thought leaders. Welcome to the Global Security and Protection Group podcast. This is your host, Ron Jacobus, and today I am joined by James Cameron, President and CEO of the Security Concepts Group, Chairman of the Board of the Executive Protection Professionals, BEPP, and also board member of the Blackwater Memorial Alumni Association. James, great to have you back here. You've been on here before, so looking forward to diving into, actually, for the first time, your security journey and your background to where you started and to where you are now today. And also looking forward to hearing an update on what you guys have coming down the pipe for the next BEPP conference. So thanks again for coming on today.
That's much appreciated. Always enjoy it.
Awesome. So let's start at the very beginning of your journey, which wasn't actually executive protection. Like many, you started in the military and then made that transition over. So why don't you start there? What was your interest in joining the military, and how did it carry you into the private sector?
Well, I joined the military in 92. For us old folks, there was no internet, didn't know anything. I didn't really come from a military family. I just, I knew I needed some sort of direction, as most kids do right out of high school. And I left 2 weeks afterwards. Didn't know what I was getting into. My friend had an airborne contract. I wanted an airborne contract, so I got that, and ended up fortunately going to 75th Ranger Regiment for a little while, and then re-enlisted, went to Italy, got out, 98, went to college, and then 9/11 happened, and I was still a young man. I think I was 30 at the time. 9/11 happened, and came back in to go overseas. Spent a significant amount of time overseas, and then came back home. And was working in an office, and a lot of my friends were over at Blackwater. This was probably early 2005. And they said, hey, they need special skill sets over here. Why don't you apply? And that's where I transitioned completely from my business, management kind of corporate ladder climbing that I was doing, and transitioned right into security services, and got picked up by Blackwater, worked for them for about 5 years. Transitioned over to Triple Canopy, moved over to their training department, and was a whips instructor for almost 2 years. And during that time, as a contractor, I already started my own company in Vegas. And from that point, I've been doing, executive protection, starting with the diplomatic security side, ever since.
Man, we've had a couple individuals on the podcast who have the Blackwater background, Rick Prado, Barry Rice, and each time I give them the opportunity, because so much is said about that era of Blackwater externally, and I'd like to give you the same opportunity to kind of give your take on what Blackwater was, what you guys represented, and what you did, apart from what's been said in various media outlets, even still to this day. I think there's a lot's been said about it. How much of that's been true externally is probably a little different story from what you guys experienced on the ground.
Oh, 100%. I'm very proud of my time I'm honored to be able to have said that I was part of Blackwater, especially during those times. There'll never be another situation where it was like that, where a lot of things were being developed on the ground from lessons learned, from hard lessons learned, not just from Blackwater, but from other protective details that were out there. You had a lot of companies, Olive Group, Dynacor, even Triple Canopy in some areas. I mean, you just had a whole lot of teams doing a lot of movements and getting caught short. And from those being caught short moments, you really had to draw for them. And, something would happen today, you're writing up a new plan tonight on how to deal with it tomorrow. And it was very, very quick. But the caliber of people that you worked with as well was amazing. That's not to say that it was infallible. Of course, no matter what organization you're in, you've got 1% that is going to just ruin the brand and ruin what everybody stands for, which is unfortunate. And we had our own stories, of that. But the mass majority, anybody that has any questions, all they do is go back and look at some congressional testimony of how many missions do we run and versus how many clients do we lose? None. How many people do we lose? I mean, there's the initial 43 that we count on, but it's been a lot more than that since. But yeah, very proud of, you know, the work. I mean, it was dangerous. I like to, for the military people that deployed, not having served on Blackwater or some of the other teams, kind of equate the 90 days that we spent over there on our rotation, because we worked 90 days, 30 days, you know, at home. 90 days is probably equate to about a year of being in country and as a military, you know, depending on where you're at, of course. And that's a broad stroke. I understand that. But we ran 6 days a week, you know, up to 16 hours a day, depending on what team you're on. We were big targets, just like the military was. You know, you see Humvees, but when you see black Suburbans coming down the road, you're a huge target, you know. And I was fortunate enough to be on the ambassador's protective detail for most of my time over there on the advanced team as one of the DDMs or one of the snipers. So we were doing a lot of running, and you know, the ambassador was very busy. And so we're just very proud. We lost a lot of good people. But I don't think, you know, I don't think there's any regrets from anybody. I think everybody did the best that they could.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, you served both on the private side over in the combat zone, as well as in the military. And both of those are kind of coming of age moments for a lot of people, military specifically. What was something that you've taken with you from, I guess, both those journey points, both in the military and then also in the private sector, serving in a combat zone, just as you did?
Well, I mean, I know it is cliche, but you know, everybody says, oh, you do it for the people left and right of you and the people behind you, right? And it's true. It really is true for the military, but it was also true contracting. You know, you go over there initially because you had special skill sets, you got hired for a specific reason, and that was all true. But then when you're on the ground there, that paycheck becomes, it's important to do the job, but it becomes a little irrelevant when you're in the middle of something, right? I mean, when you're in a gunfight, you're not thinking about, ooh, oh, you know, I'm getting X number of dollars a day. You're kind of thinking, shit, is this worth it? Pardon my language, you know? But yeah, you start thinking, you think differently because it is about those people left and right of you. And I actually have more friends still to this day that I talk to from Blackwater than I do from the military, which is, you know, I did spend a lot of time with Blackwater, though. I did spend a good amount of time in Baghdad, and then another year to 2 years in Afghanistan. So, you know, not a lot of Blackwater guys even went to both places. So it's even more of a finite group of people that did both.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting. You talk about, you know, certainly the community gets smaller and smaller, and you know, I would imagine more tight the less people that it's in. How is that carried over, you know, beyond your Blackwater time? I mean, guys fragment out to different parts of the world, the country, different jobs, but how have you guys stayed in contact professionally and also personally?
Well, I mean, you're always going to stay in contact with those that you're closest with, like the people that were on my team. Those are the guys that I still talk to a lot. And it really was, you know, we all lived together in the same camp, but you were also compartmentalized because you were on a team, right? And you didn't know what the other teams were necessarily doing. And it wasn't due to, you know, secret squirrel stuff. It was just they're doing theirs and we're doing ours. And, you know, you're so busy that you run into people, you know, for mealtimes or, you know, at the dining facility or at the gym. But yeah, other than that, you're with your team. So the crossover to that is just, I guess it's one of those things that when you're kind of faced with the worst kind of dynamic or the worst conditions, it makes everything else easier, right? So when you're running, if I'm running a detail here in Vegas, it's easy, right? Because you've been in the worst case scenario. People train for that. And I know there's a lot of training schools that, yeah, this is what I can tell you from firsthand experience. That's not, you know, in the worst case scenario, that's probably not actually how you're going to react, right? Because you can train on it. And we trained on it. I mean, we trained consistently for worst case scenario. We trained for, you know, on the ambassador's protective detail. Many people don't know how it was structured, but we'd have MPs in the front of our motorcade and we'd have MPs in the back of our motorcade. And we had to train for if we had to get the ambassador out or if they were hard room somewhere or what happens if one of the MPs go down. You know, as an advanced team, we made the decision as a team that they were part of our team. We're not leaving them behind. So we're getting in the fight. So how do we gel with them? So again, when you're out there and you're legitimately in the red zone running with a three-car motorcade, legitimately thinking, what if an IED goes off, or what if we get small arms fire, things like that. When you come to a big city or anywhere else, and you're, we just stopped at a red light, not a problem. You know, I mean, so the transition really just relaxes you in a sense, because it does become, it's not a problem. Yeah, you work through it. If you can work through the possibility of being shot at, killed, blown up, you can work through the possibility of your dinner's reservation not being maintained. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yep. Some things become very small and very irrelevant when you look at the big picture there, right?
Correct.
Looking forward, right, with the kind of the threat lens perspective, it's not out of the realm of possibility to say we'll be where we were at in the past and the future again. And we'll have a whole new generation of individuals right back in the seat that your team was, right?
Yeah.
Possibly at mass quite again. What advice would you have, you know, looking back in hindsight at where you were then, where you are now, for somebody that may step into that same seat?
I think one of the things that I liked the most about BW was there was a lot of seasoned people, right? We didn't have, you weren't getting the job initially, you weren't getting the job 18 years old, 19 years old, right? I would say the average age of the people that were running were 30s, right? They had already been to, you know, they'd already been on SF teams, SEAL teams, Ranger Battalion. You know, they were guys that had the struggles to get to where they were, made it, and were professional, you know? So I would say, listen to the people that have the experience, and don't listen to the ones that barked the loudest, because they probably did the least, you know? So listen to those people that look at their resume, you know, and validate their resume, first of all, you know, validate that what they say they did is actually true. And just listen. I mean, everybody processes things differently. I process my things differently. I'm more of an open book. Some people aren't, you know. I'll talk about things, because that's just, it's easier that way. You know, one of the things that I enjoyed, which it's kind of bad in a sense, because they say those that can't do teach, and those that can do do, right? And I remember hearing this, a good friend of mine, he went through SF selection during, you know, right at the height of the global war on terror. And so when he was going through selection, he said the instructors all were so pissed off that they were there, because they wanted to be in the fight, and they got orders that they had to go teach. And, you know, they were just angry. So they took it out on the students, basically. I like to teach, but it's not because I can't do. It's from the perspective of I've done it. I know the information that needs to be passed along, and I'm here to help. And that kind of rolls into the BEPP, really, if I be so bold to transition, of don't teach because you can't do the job. It's the teaching from doing the job that's important. You know, I still have a company that is operational here in Vegas. I don't have a training company. I don't want a training company. But if somebody offers me an opportunity to go teach a course, absolutely, 100%, because I'm passing on that critical knowledge that doesn't necessarily get taught in a training school. And it's because it's based on experience. You know, even when I do my interviews for executive protection individuals here in Vegas, I don't care what school you went to. I don't care, you know, I definitely don't care what you shoot on the range. I'm going to give you scenario based questions and see what your thought process is and how are you thinking things through. And so I know that's kind of a long winded, but to listen to those that have been there and done that kind of deal. I mean, I don't know, you know, when you're looking at the threat lens of the future, will it ever go back to the old days, you know, the Wild West when we were there? I don't see it happening, just because the politicians aren't, you know, it becomes so political, even to the point, and we all know about Benghazi. There was a lot of us that were on the ground working for embassies or working for the State Department, contractors, things of that nature. We kind of saw that writing on the wall before it even happened. We didn't know where it was going to happen, but you could see that there's going to be a day they're not going to support us, and somebody's going to get hurt, and they're not going to come get us. And, you know, we had an issue like that in Baghdad, and a good friend of mine got severely hurt. They were on venue, and some car bombs went off outside the venue. Wasn't attacking them, but it was outside. And he looked around at a T-wall, and the explosion overblast or overpressure kind of really damaged, you know, ripped half his face off, basically. And we weren't allowed to go get him. You know, it was, we had air assets. Air assets were told they could not land and that they had to drive in. And at that point, you're like, okay, what am I doing this? If the team I'm fighting for isn't willing to come get me. And it wasn't the guys that were doing the job. The operators, those guys were ready. They were at the trucks on the radio. We're ready to go. We're ready to go. It was the command and the higher echelon that said no, very similar to Benghazi. It was the political upper echelon that said no. That's where I worry in the future, because then you're not going to get those seasoned guys to want to do the job. And then you're going to throw, you know, kind of meat into the grinder of the people that want to do the job, but don't have the proper leadership or experience to do the job. And that's going to be a big problem.
Yeah. You know, you bring up Benghazi, and it's interesting that we're still talking about it to this day. And I've talked with Sarah Adams and Dave Boom Benton at length, both on the podcast here and offline, not just about that day, but the lead up and the environment that led to that situation. Yeah. And you're speaking volumes to it right now. And certainly, I mean, that's it's an unfortunate reality when you talk about the politics getting in the way of what you guys are there to do, which is protect those individuals who are policymakers, for the most part. You know, you're right. Will it be the wild, wild west? Maybe not in the same aspect, but a new generation of individuals will need to make that same balance test of, hey, am I going to go over and do this work?
Yep.
And with the same knowns and unknowns that you guys faced as well, right? And certainly you make different decisions, you know, in your age now than you do in your 20s and 30s. And it's a continual balance test with education and experience. So I think exactly what you're saying is talk to those guys who've been there, who have that experience, who can look back and look back with some perspective. Because it's harder for us guys who don't have the same, you know, time on to look backwards, because we don't really have anything to look back to in terms of firsthand experience. So looking out for those mentors is huge, not just for me, but I know for a lot of other people kind of in my space, and working with mentors like yourself and otherwise. Before we jump even further into your BEP stuff, I know you sure. talked a little bit about it. I do want to capture a little bit of your work in the United Arab Emirates. And I think it's just an interesting byline, and I'll let you talk about as much or as little as you want, but I do think it's pretty interesting.
Yeah. So I had a client that came into Vegas, and it was one of the junior sheikhs that came in here and took good care of him. You know, he was here 6 days, 6-7 days, but you can really make a large impression, I guess, in a short period of time. I became pretty good friends with the chief of staff over there. And him and I still talk to this day, as a matter of fact, on WhatsApp, and we'll shoot messages to each other. And about a month after they left, I get this email saying, hey, would you like to have a job? And it was incredibly unfortunate timing, because I was going through the interview process for State Department to actually join State on one of their programs. And I was making it through that process. And then I get this and I'm like, oh man, what do I do? You know, here's an opportunity to, you know, go live in the UAE, or here's an opportunity to continue on with State Department in an official capacity. And so I took the opportunity in the UAE. You know, this is something for some people, you get an opportunity, you take a leap of faith. True story, when I was flying over there, they don't move any of your household goods or anything like that. I asked them about that. They're like, well, you get 3 pieces of luggage. What else do you need? And I'm like, oh, okay. All right. So simultaneously, this was at the same time that Blackwater guys, when they're flying back into Iraq, were getting hemmed up, or they're getting arrested at the airport. And there was the Iraqis were doing investigations on, were you there during Nisar Square, or were you there during this, or were you there? So a lot of guys were getting arrested at the airport and being held. And so when I'm flying in the UAE, I'm thinking, is this one of those opportunities where I'm going to get arrested? Like I did not know. And I wasn't flying into Dubai. I was flying into through Etihad Airlines, and I never heard of Etihad. And so I was reaching out to my people saying, hey, has anybody heard of Etihad? And they're like, oh yeah, that's the airline out of Abu Dhabi. I was like, okay. And that's where I was flying into, was Abu Dhabi. And I'm like, well, I've never flown in Abu Dhabi. I don't know anything. And I just walked into it completely blind, which, you know, scared the crap out of me. But what do you do? You know, you take a chance. And, you know, it worked out pretty well. I got a lot of opportunities over there in the UAE. I did get put on one program where we started developing training for other Emirates. And I did live in Dubai. I mean, I commuted all over to every Emirate in the UAE. For those that aren't familiar, it's made up of several Emirates, which are like their states. And Abu Dhabi is one Emirate. Dubai is one Emirate. Fujairah, you know, Ras Al Khaimah, and all, you know, there's a bunch of different And we had locations almost in every emirate, working for different sheikhs at the time. And it was interesting because, again, I started there with nothing, with three pieces of luggage, and ended up, you know, my first apartment was a 500 square foot studio, to whereas when I left there, I had a, you know, 1200 square foot one bedroom apartment that overlooked a great lake and big buildings. And it was really an amazing opportunity to work over there. Again, got to be good friends with the CEO of the Dubai airport, would go to his house often. I would have conversations with military leaders over there, you know, just on various topics. I hold a small side story is I hold a belief, and I had the belief over there, and I have it here in Vegas, of why isn't there a terrorist attack in Dubai? And that's what I would raise that question. I'd be like, you know, I left there in 15. I got there around 10, 11 timeframe. So a lot of things were going on. Yemen was kicking off, like all this stuff was going on. And I'm like, hey, how come everyone else has been attacked? There's been Oman, Saudi Arabia, you know, how come nobody, oh, Mr. James, you know, no, not here. I was like, yeah, who are you paying? Who are you paying? Oh, we're not paying. Yeah, okay. But I transitioned that to Vegas, is that there's a lot of Arab money here in Vegas, and they come to Vegas. And I've talked to some of my Metro friends, Las Vegas Metropolitan Police, and I raise a theory of there's a back room somewhere where they're smoking shisha and they're saying, don't mess with Vegas, you know? And yes, we had the October 1st, but that was not, had nothing to do with religious ideology. And the same thing holds in Dubai. So, you know, it was kind of one of those things that I would banter back and forth, smoking shisha with, you know, some really important people in the UAE government. And just one of those things. But yeah, Dubai was very interesting. It's an opportunity to live amongst Arab culture and also travel. I travel an awful lot because you're in the center. So you can kind of go to Thailand. You can go to old Eastern Bloc countries, which I did, or in the Black Sea. So you really get a good feel and good sense, more so than the contractors that were traveling from Baghdad into Dubai overnight and then flying out. You know, when you live there, it's a little bit different. Well, it's a lot different. You know, you actually find out what's here, what you can do, what you can't do, and you kind of enjoy it a little bit more.
Yeah, you know, I guess from your time there, what was the biggest difference you took culturally in that environment opposed to how we live here in the United States?
You don't realize how much stuff you have access to here, you know, things that I can't even explain. I equated like Dubai living. I've never lived in New York, but I've had family live in New York. Dubai living to me seems a lot like living in New York, where you don't shop for a month, right? You shop for what you need today and tomorrow. So they have their little, in New York, their little bodegas, right? But over there, you've got those high-rise hotels apartments. Like I lived in an apartment that was in a hotel, which is awesome because you get housekeeping and everything. And then on the bottom floor, you had, you know, hairdresser, you had, or the salon, you had your little grocery store. So when you go in there and I want to make this for dinner. Oh, it's not here. You know, and then it's a real challenge to get to another store that may have it, you know, because parking is a nightmare. Traffic is a nightmare. So yeah, so not having all the things at your fingertips that you would normally, definitely no Costco's, no Sam Club, you know, they had one IKEA and that was in Abu Dhabi. So it was an hour and a half drive if you wanted something from IKEA, and it was always packed. So yeah. The big thing was Ramadan, you know, living through Ramadan. I think they've changed. I talked to a friend that recently went, and he said things are a little bit different then, or they're different now than when I was there. When I was there during Ramadan, you know, you could go to the mall was open, the food court and restaurants were open, but you had to take it all home. You know, those challenges, of course, you know, as not being Muslim, you know, well, I'm hungry, you know, where am I going to go eat? And you can't. So,
yeah, I think it's interesting just beyond even just the protection and professional portion of the work that a lot of people do is just the engagement that you get from that travel on the cultural side to expand, not just you professionally, but also personally, right? You take a lot of those bits and pieces from wherever you've been and apply them to your life as they fit. And you take some of those inconveniences overseas and you really cherish them once you're back home.
Exactly. And it does help you years ago. You know, not so much now because I've kind of transitioned a little bit, but you know, that's all we really specialize in Middle Eastern because we understood their culture and we were respectful of it, right? there's that learning piece too. It's not just reading about it in a book. You're like, oh yeah, okay. You know, that makes sense now. I get it, kind of deal.
Absolutely. And you're right. Flipping through a book is totally different than actually experiencing it on the ground and getting that direct exposure and trying not to step on yourself as many times as you probably do.
Yeah,
trying not to make the same mistake twice, right? It can be rather difficult when you've been ingrained for however long you've been living in a different type of culture,
right,
to make those mental shifts and have them stick. So,
yeah,
fascinating little footnote on your overall journey and career. You're still, you know, present CEO of a security company out of Vegas, and you guys do a lot of different stuff. I'll let you highlight just a little bit of what you guys do and, you know, why you guys decided to provide some of these services.
Yeah. So, when I stopped contracting, or even when I was still contracting, you kind of take a look at what the DS, Department of State model was for protection, and go, well, that it works, right? I mean, we applied it in the worst possible case scenarios, and it worked, for the most part. So let's mimic that over here. And I wasn't seeing that really anywhere. So that's when I decided to open my company. I was like, well, we're going to do it right. There's a ton of executive protection companies out there that don't have my experience, you know, or some of the training, and let's do it correctly. And so that's when I started out here. And still to this day, I mean, there's still a lot of companies out there that don't do it right. But there's also that learning curve too. Yeah, you come from a very well respected State Department way of doing things. That doesn't mean you can replicate that here, right? There's nuances here that you have to change and adapt, because, you know, if we're taking the ambassador somewhere, yeah, we can lock down a whole floor if we want. Here, you can't do that. So you always have to be able to learn and adapt and not be so rigid that you can't, or, you know, anything like that. So yeah, I mean, that was the reason coming out here and doing that. Was it was more of a, let's do it correctly, or as close to correct as possible.
That's awesome. And certainly as we transition over to discussing this conference that's coming up, we've talked about the BEPP a few times on this podcast here, had the collection of the board members on to discuss kind of the reason why behind all the doing and all the work that you guys are encompassed in. Go ahead and just throw a very broad overview of what the BEPP is for those that this is a first time listening event.
So a broad overview is the BEPP is the Board of Executive Protection Professionals. It's a gathering of initially it was the board was made up of pretty much anybody that touched executive protection, everyone from doctors to drone pilots to business owners to government agency people. And it was really to start implementing a standard for how is it we are to provide executive protection. If we're charged with the safety and protection of individuals and their families, how is that supposed to be done? What does that look like? And that's kind of why we were developed. And that's our mission. That's kind of our goal is to raise that standard or raise the standard, but set that foundation of these are the minimums that you have to do it correctly.
As you know, it's a big chunk to bite. Obviously, it's not something that's really been done. And I think that's been a gripe for a lot of practitioners in the industry, especially people starting out, kind of a little bit of confusion. You know, I know initially for me, when I first got involved in all this, it was like, wait, I need not just one license, right? But probably a many, depending on where I'm going to work. And then, of course, the appropriate workarounds for those to stay above board is now you got to start networking. Unless you have a lot of starting out, a lot of capital to do a lot of front-end costs, you're going to be doing a lot of partner networks and finding out who's doing similar work to a standard that you want it done to for a client that you care about in a different part of the country. And that, right, that kind of alleviates some of those initial limitations until you have the wherewithal to start, you know, grabbing at all these licenses, which again, any way you cut it, extremely expensive. But there is a right way and a wrong way to do things. And unfortunately, the right way is usually a lot more expensive. And that's a separate discussion of if it should be that way and if it should not be. And then I think a lot of people fall on one side of the street. But with that said, you guys have tried to set that foundation for everybody. So it's easier to even do some of that partner networking. Hey, I know that this company is doing it the same way and to a level and a degree that we find acceptable for our client to be a part of. So with that said, in addition to all the working groups you guys do, you have also decided to put on conferences, which I think is a great way to engage people. And I went to your inaugural conference. It was a unique experience in a good way, right? I mean, it felt like a lot of the fluff that is at other conferences wasn't necessarily there. And then you realize you weren't missing it, right? You guys are continuing it and you have another one coming up. So let's talk about not so much what happened at the last one, but what's coming up in the future, and not so distant future. So I'll give you the space right now to just talk about what you guys got coming down the pipe.
Yeah. So, and I appreciate the kind words for the conference. It was very stressful. Our first one was, stressful, but, we wanted to set that standard for ourselves of what have we seen elsewhere? What were the good takeaways and what are the areas of improvement? What can we improve upon? And so I think we did that very well last year. This year, the networking piece, it'll be 3 hours. So it won't be the standard 2 hours like we did last year. It'll be 3 hours because there was a lot of value there. There was a lot of engagements. There was a lot of new networking, people networking with people that they hadn't met before. The level of individuals that come to the last conference, which we anticipate this coming conference, these are professionals. And that's not to say that professionals don't go to other conferences, but these are seasoned leaders, very respectable backgrounds, current respectable jobs, and positions. And they all need something, right? It doesn't matter if you work in a Fortune, 50 company and you have a protection detail that is in-house and it's all former Secret Service, just hypothetical. You still need resources. You still need intel. You still need things that are outside of your in-house capabilities. And we're bringing all those together in a professional manner. So even to the minute detail of got to wear a sports coat. Right. You got to have a jacket. We don't want to see the tactical, look, we're professionals here. Right. And this conference, again, we're actually flying out to go do a site visit of the JW Marriott in Indianapolis, where our next conference is going to be held at in June. So we're excited about that partnership with that hotel. Again, trying to keep it centralized. So everybody got to travel a little bit. Have some great speakers lined up, just to touch on. Two of the greatest compliments that I received last year, they were the same compliment, two different people, two people that are highly respectable. Each one came up to me at a different time and said, James, I go to a ton of conferences. I never sit through everything. I sat through everything here. And I thought that's the best you could do, right? Because that means you had speakers that were engaging and on topics that were of interest to you. I was sitting next to a former deputy secretary for State Department and his phone would ring. And I know he is very high up in his corporate world that he is now. And his phone would ring and he'd put it on silent just to continue paying attention to what that person was saying. And I was like, wow, I would expect him to have to take the call, right? Get up and walk out. But no, he sat there and it was a very good experience. And we build on that, right? So last year was a day and a half of conference presentations. This year is 2 days, two solid days. Presentations from start to finish, and all great presenters, all well respected, and we're talking about relevant topics. So that's the important part, right? Is the networking and relevant topics. Keeping it where people go, I need to see that, and then also not over complicating it, where you've got breakout sessions where inevitably there's two things going on at one time that you want to see, and you have to pick your poison, right? So we try to just keep it all in line, go from presentation to presentation to presentation and topic to topic. So
this might be a good time to do it. I took a peek at the website you guys have here, and obviously we'll put all that information in the show notes so people can have easy access to it. But you've raised your attendee projection from what it was last year by 50 people, if I remember correctly. It looks like you got a solid 16 speakers as of now. I don't know if that plans to grow or not.
Yeah, that is completely set. We almost overbooked. We had more people that wanted to present than, and I didn't do the math right. I was like, oh yeah, sure. Well, yeah, cool. I want another. Oh, wait a minute. We don't have enough time slots. But I mean, even if you were to look at our presentations, I mean, we've got everything from cyber, emotional intelligence, operating overseas. The one that I'm really the most interested in, and I think people actually learn something because I actually sat in one of his other speaking engagements, is Dr. Kevin. He's got a PhD in accounting. I didn't even know that was a PhD attainable subject, but he did a really good talk on how to explain to the C-suite and get your budget approved, right? Understanding business language and how to phrase things and how to look at numbers. And so I'm very interested in seeing what his presentation is. But I mean, we have real red team operations. Rob Ross, and he used to work and do it for Meta. So real red teaming, and not the cyber side, but the actual physical security side of red teaming. Everybody talks about it, but nobody knows how to do it like this guy. So we've got a really robust list of speakers, I'd say, at least to include, you know, Mr. Sullivan and Mr. Irvine coming from American Express. I mean, so I would almost dare say this is like GSX level type of talent without having the GSX budget, if I could be so bold.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at the 16 speakers right now, and you're right. I mean, the gamut, everything from OSINT to AI, cyber, you got drone, and you've got C-suite conversations on how to get your budget passed and approved. I mean, that's some important stuff right there. And I know last year had its own unique important topics, and I was impressed at what was discussed. Right, it wasn't exactly what I thought was going to be the topics discussed going into it, right? You're used to kind of the same run of the mill. Hey, let's talk about hard skill, soft skill, whatever. But then you branch out right to some of this other stuff, and especially for business owners, operators, and they have different touch points and different things that they have to worry about. Insurance, right? The importance of mitigating some of those legal minefields that you have to run through as a business owner that you maybe don't worry about as much as just a sole practitioner working for somebody, as opposed to this is my baby as a company and I want to keep it afloat, right, and avoid some of those things that maybe some people have experienced on their own. And I think that's the best thing to do, is avoid things by learning from others who have had to learn some tough lessons. And just looking at the topics that are going to be discussed this year, I think there's a great opportunity to continue that.
One of our things also is that we also didn't want to repeat topics. We didn't want to have a same conversation. Now we do have, I mean, I'm speaking on the same topic, but it's more about where are we now with the standards. So there's improvement. The only other one that is a repeat is drones, and that's from a different perspective. So last year's drone conversation was how to implement drones and licensing, and that was the conversation. This year will be a counter drone. So it's on the same topic, but it's a totally different perspective and different view. So yeah, every year we don't want to have the same speakers. We want to elevate those conversations. Again, like you said, if you're looking for a conference to talk about go bags, this isn't it, right? I mean, it's an important topic, yes, but that's just not for this conference. We're dialed into a different group. And then also the other thing that really sets us apart for anybody that's listening and seeing about going is we give, I'm sure you took yours with you, but the presentations, all the presentations are printed and bound. I've never seen another conference do that. So you can actually take notes while the speaker's speaking instead of taking pictures of the slide and then trying to remember, oh, I took a picture, this was important, but why? So, you know, all of our attendees last year, the book was 180 plus pages. So it's a great takeaway.
Yeah, it was pretty beefy. I still have it here, and I flip through it every once in a while, right? I mean, like you said, it's got all the information there, and it allowed you to be a lot more present and engaged in listening to the conversation instead of, you're right, trying to snap pictures, trying to take entire notes instead of just the extra ones that you fill in there because you've already got most of the information at your fingertips. So I think that's great. Glad to hear that you guys are doing that again. For those who are thinking of attending, what are the specific dates? And we already alluded, it's going to be Indianapolis, Indiana, for the location.
Yeah, so all the information can be found at our website, bepp-esoc.org. The dates are June 19th through the 21st. The 19th is a Wednesday. That's where we kick off with our evening networking event for 3 hours. And then Thursday, the 20th, all-day presentation with another three-hour mixer. And then the 21st, which is Friday, again, full day of presentations. So the big warning that I would tell you, anybody that's thinking about attending, which we didn't know this when we booked it, is that Team USA, USA swim team, is actually having their Olympic trials in Indianapolis at the same time. So hotel rooms are very scarce. So if you're thinking about going, book the rooms now. And that's not trying to get, you know, push sales tickets. It's just rooms are, we don't even have that many rooms to check out on Saturday. So the Friday rooms are very limited, but we do have a room block. We do have special rates, which are all on our website. But my recommendation is get rooms as quick as possible, because you may want to come and there's just literally no place to stay. And it's not even just at the JW, it's all the surrounding hotels. They're expecting a few hundred thousand people coming in for the swim Olympic trial. So,
well, it's going to be a busy time for the city of Indianapolis. Sounds like a lot of things going on. In addition to just registering, you guys still have a an option for sponsors as well for this conference. And that's easily accessible on the website. But what kind of are you guys looking for?
That was the other thing, that when we developed this conference, we wanted to give back to the attendees and to the sponsors, make sure that they got every dollar worth. And it wasn't just a money-making opportunity for us. As an example, last year, our conference, I think, was about $180,000 to run. And at the end, there was a little over $5,000 left. So, you know, that helped cover some operating costs. So every sponsorship dollar we get, we put into promoting your business or your brand, your service. We create individual QR codes for you. We put that on all, we mention you in all of our social media links and stories. It'll be posted at, you know, all over the place at the last conference. And this conference, as far as marketing and branding, we really want to make sure that you get, that sponsors get something back. Two things that we're doing differently this year. We have one spot. If you haven't seen it already, we have an Executive Protection Advanced Logistics Guidebook, which is a little flip book. And we have an opportunity for one sponsor to put their name and logo on the front of that. there it is. Yep.
Still got it here on my desk.
One space. Yep. So every attendee will be getting that guidebook, which I guarantee every attendee will, you know, find helpful and carry with them for a long period of time. So there's one opportunity there. And then also for those that either can't attend and want their brand represented, we do have a single page advertisement space that we will provide inside of our resource guide, which is the guide that has all the presentations. So a lot of opportunities for, you know, everything from sponsoring the networking events all the way down to the single page. And again, you know, we try to provide as much value as possible to all of our sponsors and all of our attendees. This year's conference is looking to be about a $250,000 conference. So big upgrade from last year. So we definitely need sponsors, and it's a great opportunity. Two things that people have taken away: the advanced guidebook. So if you want your logo on there, you know, contact us, or the presentation guides, resource guide. Everyone took those. So that's a great way to get your name out there.
Wonderful. And we'll make sure, again, all that stuff is readily available in our show notes, so nobody has to go hunting for it. Before I let you go, how do people reach out to the BEPP and also to you? Where can they find you if they want to contact you directly for some either mentorship or professional endeavors, whichever?
Yeah, so we have a pretty good LinkedIn social media presence. We mirror everything we do on LinkedIn, on Facebook, but Facebook, again, not really our target demographic. So LinkedIn, we're definitely out there. You can do a search for BEPP or Board of Executive Protection Professionals. You can reach out to me anytime, james@ep-board.org, if you have any questions. We are working on the standard too. Just as a quick update, technical committee, we meet once a week for 2 hours a week, where we're, you know, hashing out all the verbiage for the standard. That should be hopefully getting sent to ANSI later this year. So, I mean, we're making progress on all fronts.
Great stuff. Yeah, we're all standing by to see what ends up coming back from that. And it'll be interesting to see. You guys have put a lot of work, a lot of different people from all over the place in industry coming together on that. So that'll be really interesting to see what comes of it. Excited about this next round of conferences with you guys. Certainly going to do my best to try to make it out there. But we'll see what June has in store. But I know it's going to be just like last time, a great event and a great experience for those who can make the time to make it out there. Any last words before I let you go, sir?
No, I always appreciate your audience. Appreciate you. And those that are out there going to the conference, you know, come up and say hi, introduce yourself.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's a great thing. And obviously you guys build in a lot of time for that networking. And I was amazed at everybody there. Super nice, taking time, exchanging cards. That's what it's there for, and that's what it was used. Wonderful, man. So great to have you on again. Always a pleasure, and look forward to the next time.
appreciate it, sir. Thank you. And you stay safe out there.
All right. I will. Thank you very much. And to our listeners, thank you for listening to another episode of the GSPG podcast. Until next time, stay safe.